This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This country's first normal school, a school created to instruct students to become teachers, was opened in Concord, Vermont on March 11, 1823, by Reverend Samuel Reed Hall. He was the originator of the American system of teacher training, also author of the first textbook on teaching published in America, and a pioneer in the use of the blackboard as a schoolroom appliance. Almost 200 years later, Reverend Hall might not recognize what's happening in some classrooms in Vermont, where a new method of instruction is being incorporated by teachers and professors. They've dubbed the idea flipped classrooms, and the concept is that students spend their homework time watching teachers' lectures online, and school hours are spent on more interactive problem solving. In some places, this is already happening in elementary and high school settings. In Vermont, the teachers who are utilizing this method are mostly at the college level. We're going to explore the concept today and find out how it's working with a couple of teachers who are already employing it. Laura Hill Birmingham teaches plant biology at UVM. She's in the studio with me today. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks, Jane.
And Jeff Howarth is a geography professor at Middlebury College who's on leave this semester, and we're talking to him by phone. Jeff, nice to have you as well.
Hi, Jane.
So, Professor Hill Birmingham, I'd like to start with you first and just ask you to explain how you even learned about this concept of flipped classrooms and decided to try it out for yourself.
Sure. So in fall of 2011, I was asked by my department chair to teach a genetics class, and he said that it really needed some changes. So I found out about this method of teaching. It's a DVD actually put out by one of the book publishers, and it's called Interactive Teaching, sort of the how-to, and it was presented by Dr. Eric Mazur, who's a Harvard professor of physics. So that's where I learned about the method. I tried it out in 2011. I've been doing it ever since.
And that genetics class that you taught is one that typically gets really horrible teacher evaluations at the end of the semester. So was the concept here just, we got to do something about this class?
Yeah, it needed a change. So I was challenged to make that change, but I wasn't given any specific direction. So I was able to do with it what I wanted to, and I think it was successful.
Well, what do the student evaluations say?
Well, the student evaluations were quite good. I've taught this class twice now, and I'll be going into my third year in the fall. And not all the students really love this. I got some feedback from very good students who weren't big fans of the method, and they told me why. And we can talk about that maybe at some point. But some students love it, some students don't. But what I try to do is make it clear why I use these methods on the first day and then continue to remind them why we're doing this.
Jeff Howarth, what about you? Can you maybe explain what a typical week in one of your classrooms looks like and how it might look different than what people expect a college class to look like?
Well, I teach classes where students have to apply technical skills to solve kind of real-world geographic problems. And I have a lecture lab kind of format. And so traditionally, the lab is where the students kind of acquire the technical skills that they then learn to, or that they then apply towards solving problems kind of independently. So I didn't know I was doing a flipped classroom until I started kind of teaching a little bit differently, and then I had a senior colleague tell me that I just flipped the classroom. So I was mostly just reacting to the way that I saw students kind of learning in the lab while I was teaching it the traditional way, and then just tried to make some changes about the way I delivered the content.
And how successful has it been for you?
I think it's been, you can look at success, different ways. There's the student evaluations, and maybe if how the enrollment is doing in the course, or people electing to take it rather than just being required to take it. There's, maybe learning across different learning styles. Students with certified learning disabilities have spoke pretty positively about this. Students with, English as a second language have been positive. There's other ways too. But so far it's been fairly, I think, positive, at least from the students.
Laura Hill Birmingham, can you give us a little bit more of a full explanation of what the concept of a flipped classroom is? Because, when you describe it simply in one sentence, it's easy to say, you watch the lecture at home and you do the homework in class, but it's not quite that. It's a little more complex.
It is, yeah. Actually, do spend a little bit of classroom time lecturing, but before the class meets 2-3 times a week, I have the students do a reading, usually from a textbook or from another book, and answer a series of questions in the form of a pre-lecture assignment. And they submit those online, and I get them before I see them in the classroom. So I'm able to read their responses to the questions. They're very broad conceptual questions based on the reading. And I always ask the students what they found most confusing or difficult in the chapter, and if nothing, what did you find most interesting? So that's when I get real direct feedback from the students on what they need to focus on because the textbook wasn't sufficient in making it clear. So I use the classroom time focused on those issues. And in the classroom, I also have a series of, I call them concept tests. The students buy little clicker remotes and they get to click in answers. And I usually do 3 to 4 of those per 50-minute class. And the students will, I'll lecture for a bit and then I'll pose a question at them. And then they'll answer, and I'll get their responses, and then I'll encourage them to talk to one another. It's a method called peer instruction. So they use peer instruction, they re-vote, and I always see a big increase in the right answer. And it doesn't always have to be, you know, this is the right answer. It could be a question that stimulates debate, and there is no right answer. but I teach these big lecture classes at UVM, so it gives them an opportunity to talk with one another and to problem solve together. And then after the class, they do a post-lecture assignment as well, sort of following up on what we had time to talk about in the classroom.
So in their homework, are they ever watching videos that you do? I mean, is that part of the concept that we hear about so often, especially in things like the Khan Academy, started by Salman Khan, where students can watch these lectures and then go into class and discuss them? Is that happening in your types of classes?
I don't use that particular method, actually. They do sometimes watch animations, which is helpful, but those animations usually come in the post-lecture assignment. And it's mostly reading-based, and I do most of the lecturing when I'm with them in the classroom.
Jeff Howarth, what about for you?
They do watch videos. So in the old way, I would do a live kind of 3-hour click-by-click kind of demonstration of how do you use software to solve a problem. And then they would go off and, as their homework, they would kind of apply those skills to solve a new problem. And I was basically running into kind of, I don't know, the, you know, VW van on the highway problem where the flow of traffic can only go as fast as the kind of slowest car. And so what I found is that students that wanted to go faster would get bored and would, you know, surf the web, check email, watch videos, waiting for me to get back to the pace they wanted. And then students that wanted to go slower got kind of flustered and kind of often embarrassed and would sit in the back, and that made it harder for them to see. So I just wanted to come up with a way that students could kind of self-pace the way that they were getting the kind of technical instruction. And then by doing that, you know, I have them now watch these videos so they can watch at their own pace. And then when they come to the classroom, we can focus on, you know, how do you apply these skills to solving different kinds of problems. And that's, you know, traditionally something I wasn't there to help them with. And you know, at the lower level, it's hopefully a parent's there, or at a, you know, college level, hopefully there's a study group, but the teacher isn't usually present at that kind of stage. And so now I can kind of work with students in the classroom at that kind of application stage.
When you're delivering a regular lecture, though, you know, those students who maybe didn't understand the concepts, you could either see a raised hand or you could see 20 blank stares coming back at you and say, okay, maybe I need to try this a different way. If they're watching online, their only immediate option is to rewind and watch it again, right? So how do you make sure that they're understanding the concepts that you're explaining, even if you can't just put it another way at that moment?
That's a good point. It's harder to design effective videos than it is to do a live demo, because you can improvise and you can respond to reactions when you're live. One point that's maybe worth making is that I still have a lecture component to the course. My class has both a lecture and a lab, and so I've really just flipped the kind of the lab part of it, and that's where they're kind of just trying to get the software skills. There's still the idea of they're going to ask questions, but, you know, part of it's just I try to design the instruction well, and then there's always, you know, the office door is always open, the TAs are, I have a TA that's available, and just in some ways, maybe by asking students to pause a little bit before, you know, getting a response to the question, they wind up kind of answering the question themselves. And so if they just keep a kind of a timeline of, you know, what's the synopsis of this part of the video? What are some of the concepts here? What are some of your questions about this? They can bring that to lecture. They can bring that to my office hours. Or sometimes maybe their questions will get answered by themselves or by interacting with peers.
We're talking today about flipped classrooms. At its most simple, this is students consuming lectures or consuming content outside of class and then spending the classroom setting time doing more interactive learning and problem solving, things that could be normally considered out of class work. We'd love to hear what you think of the concept, listeners, and what questions you have about how it's working. We're talking about at the college level, but we know a lot of high schools around the country are also incorporating this at lower levels, high schools, elementary schools, and we'd love to know what you think. Would this work for your kids? Would it have worked for you? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Meg who wrote on our Facebook page saying, this model sounds great, but it seems very labor-intensive for the teacher. They must create a video lecture, be present to facilitate the classroom or lab component. I'll be curious to hear what's said about this aspect. So, Laura Hill-Birmingham, for you, I mean, you're not creating a lecture video, but it still sounds like you're doing a lot of labor-intensive work to make your classes work. Is it harder to do it this way?
I think that initially, if you're building a course from scratch, you can choose to put your effort into making your PowerPoint slides for your lecture or writing your lecture notes that you'll put on the blackboard, or you can spend your time thinking about assignments that the students can respond to. Pardon me. And then in class time, again, questions that they can work through. So instead of it's just a shift in energy, I think, putting energy into thinking about problem-based questions or conceptual questions that will challenge them versus taking the notes, you know, taking the book, making them into notes and putting those notes on the blackboard or on your PowerPoint slide, which then get transferred into the student's notebook.
Right. And it sounds like for you, if you're having the students fill out this pre-lecture sort of questionnaire and you're finding out where they're not quite understanding the concepts, that means for you, you can't come in with a prescribed lecture that you're going to give and just give it that way if you're waiting to see what you need to focus on based on what the students are struggling to understand.
Right.
So you really have to be on the ball with your knowledge of the subject matter.
That's true. And I don't walk into the classroom without a plan. I do have a plan. I do have lecture modules that I deliver interspersed with concept tests. But I will focus, I'll spend more time on concepts that the students are struggling with. I'll spend less time on those that they responded well to in the pre-lecture. And sometimes I'll write a couple of concept tests right before lecture in response to some misconceptions that I've picked up before the class. So again, it's not really more effort. I do have TAs and I use the TAs for this, but there's ways to streamline it, and the Center for Teaching and Learning at UVM, I co-host workshops there, and we talk about some of the logistics of executing this in the classroom.
Jeff Howarth, for you, is it more work?
I think so. It's certainly maybe the work is maybe less important than the kinds of extra things you need to know. You wind up kind of adding video producer to the list of skills you need to be able to do, and then kind of multimedia designer, you know, because there's certainly ways to make a bad multimedia presentation for students to watch that aren't going to help them learn. So I think it kind of increases the kind of the skills and the knowledge base that's kind of required of instructors who want to do this until there's more support, you know, maybe easier, you know, software that's designed for this or more support from Middlebury has a lot of support, I think, from the LIS, the Library and Information Services and other components. And so there's some ways to get relief. It also kind of adds a layer of transparency to your teaching, you know, which is kind of interesting when you put your stuff out on video and put it out there. I mean, my stuff's out on YouTube. It's, you know, in the old days, I think, you know, the classroom was kind of like Las Vegas. What happened in there stayed in there. And there's just like, maybe students would talk about what the instructor did, but it was all kind of myth and legend. And, you know, for junior faculty, there's kind of, you know, protocol for if other colleagues can visit your classrooms. And when you, you know, put your videos out there, it's you're really showing the world how you're trying to teach, which is a great thing, but it's also different.
We're hearing already from a lot of listeners. Michelle in Berkshire posted on our Facebook page saying, you know, kids need to be outside playing and being creative, not stuck inside, giving them more reason to sit in front of a screen. Kids should be able to learn all they need to at school in a day's time. I think Michelle talking not so much about college students, but younger students. Adam says, I really see the future of education in America in what the Khan Academy is doing. Again, the Khan Academy, you can go online, watch any lecture for free on any subject. A lot of high schools are actually using some of these lectures as homework and then talking about the concepts in class. I got a note from Nelia who says, flipped classrooms are an interesting idea and an important one to consider as our educational system has changed little in the 200 years and our cultural system has changed so much. Let's be careful and critical as we consider such changes, though. And Jared said, my son is a fifth grader, fortunate enough to attend one of the select elementary schools using iPads in the classroom and at home. Recently, we kept him home from school with a stomach bug. Throughout the day, he was emailing back and forth with students in his class. The content was social in nature, but this impromptu experiment made the prospect of students who are home with an illness being able to receive real-time instruction a close reality. Jared wants to know if any schools in the state are using technology to keep kids at home connected in real time. And after our break, we're going to hear from some high school teachers who have actually tried to use this concept in class. We'll see how it's going for them. Again, you can share your thoughts on flipped classrooms by posting on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or by calling 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today about flipped classrooms, where students typically consume lectures outside of class and spend classroom time doing more interactive, dynamic learning and problem solving. It's a little bit different depending on who's teaching the class and how they're teaching it, but it's a new way of looking at how to organize the classroom setting and the work that students are doing outside, hopefully, obviously, for better results and better understanding. We're talking with a couple of college professors who are utilizing new methods. Laura Hill Birmingham teaches plant biology at UVM. Jeff Howarth is a geography professor at Middlebury College. And we've got a lot of you on the line who want to tell us what you think of the concept. Some of you have tried it, maybe in a high school setting, and others have questions. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Vermont Edition. Let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Jericho. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a high school math teacher in Chittenden County, and our school has talked a lot about this flipping the classroom and the pros and cons. And as kind of a baby step into that, as a math teacher, that what we instruct is pretty fairly linear progression of information. And so when there's a day that I'm out, depending how difficult the concept is, sort of education kind of grinds to a halt and kids are often treading water. And so what I've done is on days when I have a sub coming in for some reason, the night before, I will deliver my lecture on my iPad using an app called EduCreations, which is basically a whiteboard that records my voice. And I can give my kids a 20-minute lecture and then simply email that to my sub that night. And I've done that 3 or 4 times this year for the first time, and I've gotten a lot of really, really positive feedback from my kids about, oh, this is great, we didn't waste a day, it made a lot of sense. And then when some kids are struggling, and I'm emailing with parents will often say, do you have this last chapter or this last unit or this topic my kids struggled in, do you have a video for that? So parents are seeing that as a resource. I did try to use Khan Academy, but it's often not exactly the content I want, and so it's trying to massage that into the exactly what I want the kids to come away with can be difficult. So I found that just making my own lesson on the iPad app made a lot of sense and was straightforward. And one question I do have for the group, I'm not sure if it works, if it's an issue at the college level, but in talking about flipping the classroom, one of our concerns is if you have 25 kids in a class, you make a video, and the idea is watch the video, and then we'll do work and talk about it as a group the next day. When five of those 25 kids don't watch the video for whatever reason, sort of how do you deal with that? That's it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Peter, thanks for the call. Laura, let's start with you. I mean, because you are asking students, for example, to fill out pre-lecture questionnaires. If they don't, and you're relying on that for, you know, how to structure your lecture time, what about what Peter's saying? You know, if people aren't doing this, how then does it work in the classroom?
Right. Well, I teach larger classes. My smallest class is 50 students, and I teach up to 250 students. So I still get a fair amount of responses from these students, even if a handful didn't do the assignment, and that usually always happens. So in the classroom, I tend to teach to those who are present and there and are ready to learn and have done the work. And hopefully those that haven't will get caught up pretty quickly or come and talk with me.
Jeff, for you, I mean, has this been a problem for you with students not watching the lecture? And you know, actually, while we're talking about that with Peter, we got a note from UVM professor John Burke, who had the same question. You know, I do wonder how closely students pay attention to video lectures and podcasts when they're outside of class, he says, and have their attention divided by TV, cell phones, and video games. John Burke wondering if anybody studied that. So incorporating both that and Peter's thoughts, what do you think, Jeff?
I think it's important for, you know, to do assessment, not just of, you know, as much of what the students are learning, but also kind of how effective your teaching is. And so I give quizzes kind of between they finished watching the videos before they kind of do the problem in the live session to kind of see how it worked. And that incentivizes, you know, them to kind of pay attention to the videos. And, you know, it is fortunate to teach at Middlebury because I don't run into the problem of students not coming to class prepared too often. But they're basically quizzes before, after the videos, before the application is the way that I've been going at that.
Let's go to Marcia, who's calling in from Enosburg. Hi, Marcia. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm a teacher up in Cold Hollow Career Center, and I deal a lot with teaching graphic design technology, and I've been playing with this idea because I've noticed that the walls of the school are coming down anyway. I mean, I'm in constant communication with my students outside of class with email. Pardon me, I'm walking a dog, so I'm a little out of breath. But the biggest problem I have, well, there's several big problems. One is the technology. All the kids up there have iPads, but if they don't have internet service, they won't do them any good at home. At the high school outside of my class, they're very busy. They never seem to have time. And when they go home, just like that Berkshire teacher was saying, I mean, they've got work, they've got other things, or it's also the greatest excuse in the world. You know, forget the dog eating my homework. We didn't have internet last night, so therefore I couldn't do the work. Is something I have a hard time arguing with, you know. I can't prove it.
Right.
You know, at least the other way you could say, well, you don't have a dog. But that seems to be one of the rate limiting factors. The other one is that I'm noticing these kids all have iPads, they all have access to all this technology. There's very little razzle dazzle for them. It's very normal. And they really like having me teach it to them. They don't, you know, I put them up on video and such, and they would much rather have me work with them on a one-to-one basis. And maybe I'm not doing it right.
Marcia, I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate the call. You know, it's tricky, no matter what you're teaching, to figure out the right method and how to engage your students. And I hear you struggling with that in whatever method you're using. And I suppose, you know, Laura Hill Birmingham, my question for you is, you know, how do you make sure you're engaging the students? Because it's not a way of not teaching them. You know, if you're doing something like Marcia, creating a video, but then you have the students who I imagine even at the college level might say, just tell me tell me what you want me to know. I don't want to have to tell you what I don't understand.
Right, exactly. And that's why some students do not like these methods, because they do just want me to tell them what they want, what they need to know, so they can memorize it and to pass the exam with a good grade. So part of, in response to the question in the comments, not doing the assignments or not being engaged with the assignment, that's why I write my pre-lecture assignments as big conceptual questions. They have to do the reading. And again, I assign readings, not really videos, before class. So I am still talking with them. I do a bit of lecturing while I'm with them in the classroom. But the other thing is, if they don't do the reading, or even if they do, I still continue to challenge them while they're in the classroom, while I'm there with them. So it gives them the opportunity. This is just using class time efficiently. We have, in college at least, we have little time together in the classroom. So it's a way to maximize that time that we do have together. So I'm floating around the classroom working with the groups as they're working together. So that's one way that those who have done the assignment can help others. Those who haven't can hopefully get up to speed during the classroom with my help and others.
We got a note echoing what, one of the things that Marcia had been saying as well about internet availability, which may not be as much of an issue at college. Certainly colleges often, I mean, at least when I was there, provided Wi-Fi for students. So every student had the opportunity to have internet in their dorm room. Every student had access to a computer lab. Jocelyn says, I think Jocelyn's a teacher. She posted on Facebook saying, my biggest issue is internet availability at home. My own internet connection is sensitive to the weather. And she says, my students live in similar situations or don't have home internet. So I'm not inclined to rely on a child having internet or computer access, which certainly is an issue in rural communities in Vermont for high school or elementary school teachers who are trying to look at this stuff. Let's take a call from Sam, who's on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a current college student. I'm currently attending UVM, but I did transfer there from a school in Connecticut, both engineering programs at UVM and in school in Connecticut. And one thing that I found with this whole flipped classroom idea is that it works really well with certain disciplines and certain subjects. But personally, engineering, the class I had it in was a very intense building block class that if you didn't really understand what was going on there, you'd have a much harder time later on. And that was one of the things we dealt with. We would have sort of videos. The night before, we had alpha and omega assignments, so assignments before class and assignments after class. And certain ones were videos going over how to do certain types of problems, and then on the omega assignments were more homework. But then during the class time, we'd have the professor talking to us, going over a little bit, but then most of it was in problem sets and getting the practice. And if we didn't understand something, we could ask questions.
That works for you? You like it?
I like the idea, but the practice, at least in the discipline I was in, was very difficult to, if I didn't get it in the video or in the whatever assignment we had before class, there wasn't a whole lot of time during class to get a really good understanding of it. So it was very dependent on our desire to learn it, which mm-hmm. is great. But in, you know, college engineering classes, you know, your textbook's very dry, very boring, and very linear. And if you don't know exactly what you don't understand about the problem, it's very hard to figure that out. So I guess I was just wanted to comment and maybe ask the college professors at UVM in the middle of Barry, what they sort of, you know, they, it's a little bit different, I guess, when you get into those much more intense mathematical and physical sciences.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what their opinions would be.
Yeah, Sam, let's put this to Jeff Howarth. I mean, Jeff, you're a geography professor at Middlebury, but you're teaching the GIS concepts, and it can be very technical. What about what Sam is saying? You know, he's saying if you don't understand that lecture that you're watching, it's very hard to get caught up.
Right. So I've been primarily using the videos for the software component, which is just largely kind of helping students navigate the user interface of some software system. And then that's kind of how you apply a more general concept in geography, which is probably, you know, the underlying kind of spatial relationship that you're kind of implementing. And so the I think the software, you're correct in that this method is valuable in some types of disciplines, maybe, or some subjects more than others. The ability to kind of learn skills at your own pace and then apply them, I think, is nice. Whether it's the general ideas behind the software, whether those are kind of dry and maybe are better presented in a live format where you can kind of exchange more and be personable, that's an interesting idea. But for the most part, I've been using this to kind of do the software training component of the class so that I can focus on the kind of the broader kind of problem-solving ideas in a more interactive format.
We got a note from Donna who says, I work in the Edmonds Elementary School Learning Center, and I've noticed that students pay closer attention to a video lecture than the same lecture given by a teacher in person. Donna suggests maybe it's their fascination with technology. And Miss Miller says, I've been teaching for 25 years, and trying something new is always scary, but I've started slowly, and I have flipped a big project that my students do. In a recent project, students have taken charge of their own learning, and the biggest change is that during the class period, I hear their voices, not my own. They're helping each other, and they do much more work outside of class voluntarily than they ever had before. Just got a couple seconds left, but Laura, I wanted you to let you leave us with a couple of thoughts on this concept.
Sure. So Sam mentioned that it was an introductory course in engineering that he was taking, and I also teach introductory biology, and I think that that class is the best use of these techniques. And I think that's true because there's this constant feedback that I get from my students outside of the classroom, before class, and in class. So it's that feedback loop that lets me know that they are confused, they need extra help, we'll spend extra time there. So hopefully none of my students leave with confusion. And the other part is that it really builds a sense of community in these lecture halls where you can be you can really get lost in the crowd. So it creates an ability for these students to interact with me and interact with one another, especially in these large lecture classrooms.
That's Laura Hill Birmingham. She teaches plant biology at UVM. We've also been talking with Jeff Howarth, a geography professor at Middlebury College. Laura, Jeff, thanks very much to both of you for helping explain the idea of flipped classrooms. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks.
Coming up, we're going back to the basics when it comes to photography. We'll celebrate Worldwide Pinhole Photography Day next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Do you know what holiday is happening this weekend? Not Mother's Day. You've still got a couple of weeks to prepare for that. This Sunday marks Worldwide Pinhole Photography Day, and aficionados of this simple method of taking pictures are celebrating in Brattleboro with a full day of events. We're joined now by Al Karivi, a board member at the Vermont Center for Photography in Brattleboro. He's the organizer of this weekend's events there. Al, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks for showcasing Vermont Center for Photography.
So tell us, Al, first of all, what's so great about pinhole photography that it deserves a worldwide holiday?
Well, there's probably more than one thing, but the first thing would be that it's such a simple, intuitive process that gets you completely away from the digital world, and that's probably my favorite part.
Why, though? I mean, in this age of immediate gratification where you can take a picture, see it immediately, share it with your friends and family immediately, have it all over the web, what still makes pinhole photography so appealing?
I think it's the experimentation involved. When you take a photograph with a pinhole camera, you don't really know what it's going to look like. And there's a lot of physics involved and guesswork and serendipity and it's way more exciting than checking something in the back of a digital camera a second later after you shoot it.
You said that you love it partly because of that. It sounds like you've been doing pinhole photography for quite a long time now. What got you started?
I have. I first bought my first pinhole camera in the 90s when I took a workshop at the Maine Photo Workshops. And it was just an interesting object. And I thought, that's not expensive. That looks like fun. So I bought it, played with it a little bit, and then kind of sat on the shelf until, like every other photographer in the world, I had to go digital or not be a photographer. So I am a commercial photographer. So I took the plunge to the dark side and then realized why I bought that pinhole camera, to keep me sane, mostly.
You are spending this Sunday at the Vermont Center for Photography teaching people how to make pinhole cameras and providing supplies. Other people can bring their own supplies if they want. So just give us the basics. How do you actually make a pinhole camera?
Well, a pinhole camera is just like what it sounds like. A camera means room, so it's a small room. Actually, it can be a big room. It can be an apartment or a garage or a garbage can.
Or it can be a tiny shoebox or something very small.
Yeah. I've made a pinhole camera out of a Altoids tin. That was a nice little one. It's a 35-millimeter piece of film really nicely.
Huh.
And then the other part of it is the pinhole, which is just what it sounds like, too. It's a little hole in a little thin piece of metal that's as thick as a pin is, so it just lets a little spot of light into the camera.
And so you have this little spot of light that lets a little spot rather that lets light into the camera. So what do you use, photo paper or film, and then how do you develop it?
Well, yeah, depending how extravagant your pinhole camera is, you load it in the dark room with film or photo paper, or it can be color film, it can be color negatives or transparencies. Cover up the little pinhole when you go outside and then when you're ready to take an exposure, you undo the pinhole and count whatever seconds you think it might be. Usually that's a little trial and error involved in that. And then we can go back into the darkroom on Sunday and we'll process it and see what came out. And it's usually an exciting part for somebody who's never done that or even worked with film before.
How do you have any idea how long you're supposed to expose that paper or that film for?
Well, film is faster than paper, so on my pinhole camera I use most of the time, it's in bright sun, it's 15 seconds, so I kind of know that. If it's a dark day or around dusk, I take a good guess, 5 minutes. I've actually, in really dark conditions, I've just kind of walked away from the camera and walked back later, and I don't even know how long it was sitting there, but it often will come out. Not everything comes out, but that's okay. So it's trial and error. So when we make our pinholes on Sunday, you could probably figure out some mathematical formula what it should be, but then it's just too complicated. So we just do a little trial and error and do a test shot and see what comes out and what doesn't.
You mentioned that you made a pinhole camera out of an Altoids tin. What other weird and exciting things have people made pinhole cameras out of?
Boy, you name it. I've made one out of a globe that was to celebrate Worldwide Pinhole Day a couple years ago. One of our board members made one out of a potato. I'm not sure how well it worked. I don't think it wasn't really dark inside, so maybe it wasn't too successful.
Yes, potatoes are a little too translucent.
Yeah, maybe. But the potato wasn't big enough. Making them out of a room is really a fun thing. You can be inside a room if you completely darken it, make a little pinhole in the window, so cover the windows with black plastic, make a little pinhole on the opposite wall, you'll see whatever's outside the room. And you could take a piece of film and stick it on that wall and get a little part of that as an image if you'd like.
Are the images really art, though, or really good? I mean, if you've spent any time with children who've made pinhole cameras and then given you a picture, sometimes it's just kind of a blurry image. I mean, do you think they're real art?
Well, yeah, first, I think sharpness is overrated, and I kind of gave up a long time ago deciding what was and what wasn't art. I'm kind of doing it as whatever interests me, and that's plenty for me, so I'll let other people decide if it's worth doing or not, but it's fun for me.
And you have real images that you like a lot. I mean, that you actually have them up on your own professional website.
I do. I've shot those for a while, and then one point I realized, oh, they should be big. So I made 20x24-inch prints, and I love that. So I started spending a lot of money on paper and chemicals and making big prints, and it just seemed to work for that imagery. Mostly I photograph very close in to things. I like get a bug's eye view of things, so it has a viewpoint that you might have to lay on the ground to look at if you wanted to see what the camera was seeing.
And this weekend, the events at the Center for Photography start at 11 on Sunday, and people can just come. They don't have to bring any of their own materials?
Right. We'll have, unless 100 people come, we'll have plenty of supplies. But at 11, we'll talk about what a pinhole is and maybe some history of it. 11:30 to 1, we'll actually construct a pinhole camera. You have to paint the inside of an oatmeal can or a cookie tin, and then we'll drill a little hole in it, make a little hole in some brass shim, attach it, and figure out how to put the film inside or the paper, whatever people want to use, in the darkroom. And then from one on, we'll go out and have a little photo odyssey, and there'll be people walking all over Brattleboro with their pinhole cameras with a lot of other people wondering what they're doing.
So that's what you can do on Sunday. Photographer Al Karivi has been telling us about the events at the Vermont Center for Photography in Brattleboro to celebrate Worldwide Pinhole Photography Day. Al, thank you very much.
Thank you, and please come on down. It should be fun.
This weekend, bodybuilders from around the region will gather at South Burlington High School to strike a pose, strut their stuff, and try to overpower the competition. One of the contenders is Omar Ahmed, a young Somali refugee who now lives in Vermont. Ahmed is hoping this contest will propel him into the big time. VPR contributor Jessica Tickton has a profile of this bodybuilder known as Somali Muscle.
Omar Ahmed wants to do more than build his own body. He also wants to help build his community. Omar dreams of becoming a professional bodybuilder, and he believes that will propel his career and his community.
Bodybuilding is one thing that I love to do. I don't want to be a big bodybuilder, but I mean, what I do is it's called man's physique. That's what I want to be, healthy, stay in shape, and help my community.
Fitness has always been a part of Omar's life, either on the soccer field or in the gym. But his fitness goals totally changed last April when Omar went to see his friend, Patrick Miller, compete in a bodybuilding competition.
Last year, he was competing. There's a time that I decided to become a man's physique because I saw like a couple of four guys come out. I'm like, look, I look myself. I went to the bathroom and look myself. I'm like, really? I can do this. I was like, yeah, for sure. I can compete this next year.
So Omar decided to become a bodybuilder himself. He'll compete this weekend in the hopes of winning in the men's physique category, which would qualify him for national competitions and eventually, down the road, lead to professional status. Up to now, there has never been a Somali pro bodybuilder. And Omar, whose nickname is Somali Muscle, thinks he's ready to change that.
If you come here, I feel like you can be anybody. America is the only country that you can be anything. You can be whatever you want. No one can stop you, but unless you stop yourself.
Omar says Arnold Schwarzenegger was inspirational. Omar used to pore over photos and videos of the famous bodybuilder turned politician. But Omar also wants to change the popular stereotype of a Somali, especially a refugee, as skinny, narrow-framed, and malnourished. Omar is 5'8", and he describes himself as a skinny 150 pounds before he started bodybuilding. Now, he's broad-chested and weighs a lean and muscled 178 pounds.
The dream that I have is maybe one of these days opening my own gym or helping the community. Even it's not only Somali, it's not only my community, for everybody living in Vermont.
This isn't the first time Omar has laid out a goal and set out to achieve it. He came to Vermont with his family in 2003 from a refugee camp in Kenya after his family had to leave Somalia due to the civil war. Omar was one of the first Somalis at Burlington High School in 2005. He applied to Youth Build, a 10-month program for young people who get job training while earning a high school diploma. The director, Andrew Jope, remembers Omar well.
Proficiency in the English language was limited. All along, he was really able to overcome any of those barriers through a lot of motivation. He has, especially for, you know, at the time he was like 18 years old, he had a really uncommon level of motivation for anyone, let alone an 18-year-old.
Omar's dedication to his new sport is similar to his devotion to his studies. Discipline, structure, and self-control are all integral to his life. As a personal trainer and mentor to young Somali men, he tries to help them stay out of trouble by inspiring them to embrace these values. His training regimen includes working out twice a day, five times a week. His friend and training partner, Patrick Miller, explains.
We do weight training together 5 days a week.
As a Muslim, Omar also prays five times a day and can often be found at sunrise at the Islamic Center in Colchester. Omar also dreams of going to college, opening up his own restaurant in Burlington, serving up Italian-influenced Somali food, opening his own gym and helping both the elders and the youth, both Somali and Americans, get fit and transform their lives.
One thing that I have in mind is maybe after my competition, I was thinking to go to Minnesota. They have like a Somali TV. Go in there, interview, and you know, like give them the whole community advice, especially all the people that I'm trying to help them. You know, like when they came here, they struggled for a lot of sickness, a lot of problems.
But the immediate goal is to advance in bodybuilding, starting this weekend. And from there, the man known as Somali Muscle says he may just continue to lift any obstacle in his path and fulfill them all. For VPR News, I'm Jessica Ticton.
Omar Ahmed will compete at the NPC Vermont Bodybuilding Fitness Bikini and Physique Championships this Saturday at South Burlington High School. You can find some photos of his training at vpr.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel will be in the host chair, and he'll be talking with Congressman Peter Welch. Bob's here now with a preview of what they'll be discussing.
Jane, there's a lot happening in Congress these days. We'll talk about the immigration reform bill, the future of gun control legislation, and Congressman Welch's efforts to require large internet retailers like Amazon to charge the state sales tax on all purchases. That's a plan that could bring more than $20 million into Vermont's general fund next year.
So lots to talk about with Congressman Welch, and you can send your questions for him to vermontedition@vpr.net, and then be sure to tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.